On this episode of Skeptico, Alex talks with social psychologist and sometime parapsychology researcher, Dr. Daryl Bim.
Here we have Carolyn Watt, Richard Wiseman, pretty radical atheist. I mean, I don't know if you've ever heard about this Edinburgh Secret Society thing that they do, but I think it paints a picture of the kind of person that is very radicalized towards this atheistic worldview that really represents a very small minority of the overall population. I guess the question is, do you really think that you have a chance of getting a fair shake with these folks?
Well, that's a funny way to put it. I think they have established their reputations, and he's made a total career out of being a debunker and an extraordinarily successful person at getting public attention to his pronouncements. And I take a much more sort of benign psychological view of it. He has a great career going by being a debunker. If there's anything dishonest there, is when you publish an article, even if it's of your own three experiments, you always have a literature review section where you talk about all the previous research and known research on the topic before you present your own data. And what Wiseman never tells people is that they knew that there were three other studies that had been submitted and completed, and two of the three showed statistically significant results replicating my results. But you don't know that from reading his article, and that borders on dishonesty.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and on this episode of Skeptico, we're going to talk parapsychology with none other than Dr. Daryl Bim. Now, one of the areas in parapsychology that a lot of people find strange but also very interesting is this idea of precognition. That is, can we know stuff is going to happen before it happens? Well, last year, Dr. Bim, who is extremely highly regarded in the psychology community as a whole, in addition to the parapsychology community inside of that, published a series of experiments showing that maybe this relationship we have with the past and with the future isn't all that we think it is. It's a fascinating topic, and you really gotta admire Dr. Bim's steady hand in looking at this research. Here's my interview with Dr. Daryl Bim. Today we welcome Dr. Daryl Bim to Skeptico. Dr. Bim is a very highly regarded social psychologist and professor emeritus from Cornell who created quite a stir last year with his paper, Feeling the Future, Experimental Evidence for Anomalous Retroactive Influences on Cognition and Affect. Dr. Bim, it's a great pleasure to have you on Skeptico. Thanks for joining me.
Good to be here.
A lot of our audience is going to be familiar with this paper and your work, but for those who are not, can you tell us a little bit about it, and in particular, why you published this little package of well-defined psi experiments the way you did?
Okay. The experiment, or the article, contains 9 different experiments. About half of them are actually replications of the others, because I didn't want to publish something that I had only done once. Because I wanted to make sure at least I could reproduce them again, if necessary. And as the title of the article suggests, I call it retroactive causation or retroactive influence. People are more familiar with the phenomenon just under the term precognition, the ability to respond to a future event, and that's an event that could not be anticipated by any normal inferential process that we know of. And so what I did, because I wanted to address my fellow academics or my colleagues, particularly in social and cognitive psychology, and so what I did was I looked through the literature of social psychology and said, I would like to take several very familiar phenomena that social psychologists already believe in and show that I can reverse them. That is, instead of presenting the stimuli and then measuring the response, I would reverse them in time and measure the response before I provided the stimuli.
Give us an example. Give us one of the examples of one that you did that people will immediately grasp.
Sure. The first one, and the easiest to understand, and the one that got me on the Colbert Report, in fact, was just a reversal of the most well-known effect in psychology generally, and that is reinforcement. Namely, a rat, when given two bars to press, will press the one that he or she has been rewarded for in the past. And so I reversed that by saying, can we get the rat, in this case college students, to select the alternative that will be rewarded in the future? And so what I did was I presented on the computer, the entire experiment's run by computer, and there were two curtains side by side on the screen, and the participant was told that behind one of the curtains is a picture, and behind the other curtain is just a blank wall. And they were to, on each trial, there were 36 trials, on each trial, they were to select one of the two curtains.
And it was a picture that these college students wanted to see, right?
Well, yes, we also warned them. In fact, we had to get permission from them to do this. Half of the pictures were erotic pictures, sort of people engaged in nonviolent but sexually explicit acts. And so what we did was they would select one of the two curtains. The curtain would open and reveal either a picture or a blank wall. Now, unknown to them at the time, although it probably didn't matter whether we had told them ahead of time or not, there actually was no picture behind either of the two curtains at the point at which they made their decision. They made their decision, and then, and only then, the computer flipped a coin to decide which curtain would have the picture behind it, and also flipped a coin to decide whether it would be an erotic photograph or a neutral photograph, a positive picture without sexual overtones. So they did that in 36 trials, and then we just tested the hypothesis that people would be able to detect the location, the future location, of the erotic picture more than 50% of the time, where 50% represents what you would expect by chance, since there it was like a coin flip. They had one of two curtains to select from. And what we found in that particular experiment was that an unselected set of subjects would get the right answer about 53% of the time, and those we identify as extroverts, for reasons I won't go into right now, would be able to do so 57% of the time.
Wow, that's impressive.
That's one experiment.
Great. So, great. And this paper, as you just mentioned, received a lot of positive media attention. As a matter of fact, you kind of broke through a barrier there that science often doesn't get through, and you're on Comedy Central's Colbert Report. You're on a lot of media outlets. What was that whole experience like for you, and what have you learned from that?
Well, it took me by surprise. First of all, my article wasn't published till March, and so I didn't expect anyone to know about it till it actually appeared in the journal. But a blogger for Psychology Today, the magazine Psychology Today, a woman who's herself a professor, apparently attended a meeting in which one of my former graduate students told her about this. So she blogged about it without ever contacting me. And that's when the media storm hit. It was picked up first by New Scientist, a weekly publication, and they've now done three articles on it. And then what I've learned is something about how the new media works. It was then picked up by lots and lots of others. Outlets, ABC News, NBC, and oddly enough, Al Jazeera. I share with Osama bin Laden the honor of being on Al Jazeera. I must say, Steve Colbert, who's of course primarily a comedian, the interview with him, while directed toward being humorous, was actually one of the more accurate and sensible interviews of all the ones I held.
Amazing.
It's partly because he's so smart.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's on top of his game pretty well.
Yeah, right.
Let's talk a little bit about the field of parapsychology. You know, a couple episodes ago, I had the opportunity to interview Dr. Carolyn Watt, parapsychology researcher from the University of Edinburgh, former president of the Parapsychology Association, and as far as I can tell, a pretty hardcore skeptic. Or let me throw someone else in the mix here, her husband slash partner, Dr. Richard Wiseman, another hardcore skeptic who's very active. We've had him on the show a couple of times, very active in debunking any claims related to parapsychology. This, to me, seems like a very strange situation where you have these debunkers, arch skeptics, kind of in the same pot with the folks who are trying to do this parapsychology research. What do you make of that? Is that a strange situation? You have a broad base of academic experience. Is this at all unusual?
It's unusual because it's a controversial area of research. So I'm not familiar with that kind of operation in virtually any other areas of psychology. And we've also seen it in non-psychological areas like the claims of cold fusion and things of that sort. But it is unusual. And we make a distinction between skeptics and what we call deniers, sort of the difference between agnostics and atheists. And many of the people who identify themselves as skeptics have even said, although not Wiseman, but people like Ray Hyman have actually said that no amount of data can convince them. Well, that's not how science works. It seems to me a scientist is almost necessarily an agnostic about things, which means willing to test and look at the data. I will say about Wiseman, however, that he is probably the smartest and best well-informed of all the those who identify themselves as skeptics. And I don't know quite where to place Carolyn Watt. Now, she herself, in her interviews with her, said she doesn't consider herself a dyed-in-the-wool skeptic. And in fact, she has contributed to the experimental literature. So I don't know quite where she stands. It might fluctuate with her relationship with Richard.
Let's probe that just a little bit as much as we can and as much as it's relevant to this conversation, because I think, as you alluded to, I think it is relevant. I mean, it seems to be lying right beneath the surface here are these really hardcore culture war, bordering on religious aspects of this debate. You know, here we have Carolyn Watt, Richard Wiseman, pretty radical atheist. I mean, I don't know if you've ever heard about this Edinburgh Secret Society thing that they do, but, you know, right off the website, it says they contact spirits and summon the devil as part of their show, their thing that they do. And on one hand, I don't care what people do in their spare time. But on the other hand, I think it paints a picture of the kind of person that is very radicalized in one way towards this atheistic worldview that really represents a very small minority of the overall, you know, population. And I just got to feel like that weighs heavily on this culture war debate that's really right beneath this debate on the surface over psi. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, that may characterize some people. I mean, interestingly, we have a number of fundamentalists and who actually believe in ESP, but believe it is the work of the devil. And so we have some odd believers on on the other side as well. I don't think I wouldn't characterize Wiseman in those terms. As I say, he's very well informed. He was trained at Edinburgh in the part of the psychology department that is the parapsychology wing. So he knows what he's doing when he's trying to replicate, and as I say, he's the smartest of them all. Some of them are truly dumb, but he's not one of them.
Right, and I don't claim that he's not intelligent. We've had him on the show a couple of times. I think he's deceptive.
Yeah, he is.
I've had Rupert Sheldrake on the show, and you know, he's one of the few people who have just come out and flat out say the guy's deceptive. He's been deceptive for 10 years. I engaged in an experiment with him, and he
fudged the data and recast everything and yeah. you know, did a lot of unethical, very questionable things. So again, so I'm not really putting down his intelligence or his ability. Yeah. I think he's a great debunker. I think he's a radicalized atheist, and I don't think most people know that or factor that in. I guess the question is, do you really think that you have a chance of getting a fair shake with these folks?
Well, that's a funny way to put it. I think they have established their reputations, and he's made a total career out of being a debunker and an extraordinarily successful person at getting public attention to his pronouncements. And I take a much more sort of benign psychological view of it. He has a great career going by being a debunker, one that he wouldn't match what he had done if he had, you know, been one of the regular parapsychologists. So rather than look for deep hidden motives, I tend to look at the more simple one. He's extraordinarily successful at being a debunker, and he's more knowledgeable and in some ways more honest than someone like Randy, the magician, who offers $1 million to anyone who can, you know, demonstrate ESP.
Right. Well, I think the final chapter in James Randi has been written in this latest legal trouble that he's gotten into with his life partner, where he's clearly broken the law, and Randi has aided him in this really pretty serious identity theft that he's engaged in for years. So it's
Randi is always. I mean, I myself am a magician. Who in my past, and that's how I got into this field, I have done stage magic, namely mentalism, that is fake ESP, ever since I was in high school. And the way I got into this field was the Parapsychological Association asked me to come give my performance, my stage performance, to their convention, and because they wanted to be able to protect themselves against people who might enter their labs claiming and knowing how to fake ESP and sort of subvert their research. Mm. And so I went and did my performance, and I was a skeptic at the time. I didn't know the literature. And someone there, namely Chuck Honerton, who now deceased, was setting up a new laboratory at the time, and he asked me to come to his laboratory and to examine his experimental methods, and both from the point of view of a magician and the point of view of a social psychologist who does lab experiments, and see if they were airtight. And I looked at it, and in preparation for the visit to his laboratory, I started reading the literature and was struck by how strong it was. I had never seen that. So I have some sympathy for people who aren't familiar with all the research that's already gone on. So anyway, I said to him, you know, I have one major talent, and that's getting published in mainstream psychological journals. And if you get positive results with this technique, then I will try to get them published in a mainstream APA journal. And we did. He got positive results, and we wrote it up. And in 1994, we published in the Psychological Bulletin, which is a highly regarded APA journal, the report of those studies were in telepathy. And so then I thought, you know, I'd like to gather my own data. I mean, these were not my data, although I believe them. And so that's when I started my lab. So I've only been in this a few years. My reputation over the last 40 years has been in just mainstream social psychology. And that is why I deliberately designed these studies to, first of all, use a familiar phenomena to psychologists, but also to be very, very simple in conceptualization, to be trivial to analyze statistically, and to be able to use just college students as the participants. Mm-hmm. And the whole reason for all of that is I wanted to encourage my fellow psychologists to replicate them, because everything rests upon replication.
Right.
And that's to go back to your very original question. Why did I make these packets available? Anyone who wants to replicate them can write me, and I will give them access to a complete instruction manual, all the software that runs the experiment, including the software that collects and analyzes the data. And that was all deliberate. That was all designed from day one to encourage other people to try to replicate them.
Well, that's great. And it's also interesting how you came to the field and the background that you bring in terms of being a mainstream psychology researcher. You know, a couple of I've had a chance a couple of times to interview Dean Radin, and I've really appreciated his perspective on parapsychology, having been at it for a number of years.
Yeah.
But I always asked him, the question that was on my mind is, you know, hey, why are you focused on doing these experiments with general population, college students or people who walk in off the street? Why not the superstars? And he gave what I thought was a very good answer. He said, look, we have a pretty good body of research that establishes that this is a real phenomena. What we need to do is move past that and maybe understand what aspect of our ordinary experience overlaps with that. And I thought that was a pretty good answer at the time, but I go back and I wonder, when I look at the storm of controversy that this creates, your publication creates, are we really there yet? Are we at the point where we can say, okay, we're past establishing it, let's just see how it works in the general population? Or should we be studying the superstars to better firmly and finally establish that this does happen, at least in some people sometimes?
Well, I have a similar but not identical answer to that. I do think we in the field are beyond the point of just trying to prove its existence. And the time has come to really bore down into what are its characteristics, how does it work, can we possibly come up with a mechanism to explain it? And so I agree with that part of it. But I tend to agree with people who raise the issue, why work with unselected students? And Ed May, a physicist who's in this field, has often said, you know, if you want to study high jumping, you don't go out onto the street and ask random people to high jump for you. What you do is you find the world's best high jumpers and study them, because that is the way to understand what it's about. And I agree with that. And the reason I use unselected college students is because I wanted to encourage other people to replicate it. And if I were just using the top 1% of Psi talented people in the country, other people, my colleagues in mainstream psychology, would not be able to try to replicate it. And so who's the population most accessible to my colleagues? And that's, you know, as we often joke, it's white male sophomores taking Psych 101.
Right.
And so I had a tactical or strategic reason for doing that. It's the easiest thing to do, and I wanted purposely to do the easiest thing. But I also agree with Ed May. I think we learn more, actually, by studying the truly talented people. And Dean Radin himself, you know, studies Zen Buddhists, Buddhist masters, Zen masters. And so when he wants to really show something, he uses people who've had 25, 30 years of deep religious of training in meditation and psych-related phenomena.
Dr. Ben, what do you tell people that come up to you, and I'm sure this happens all the time, and tell you about their precognitive experience, their dream, their premonition, the deja vu experience they've had? What do you tell them when they say, Dr. Bem, is this real? What's happening to me?
Okay. I actually get 4 or 5 emails every day of people telling me about this.
Do you really? Good for you.
and many of them say to me, you know, I'm also gay, and it was easier to come out to my family as gay than it is to tell them that I've had these precognitive experiences, because wow, they'll think I'm crazy.
Yeah.
And so there are a whole bunch of people who write me and are sort of, to use the same phrase, in the closet about their experiences on this. And when I was a complete skeptic, way back before I got involved in all of this, I would be able to point to the hundreds of ways that we social and cognitive psychologists have learned that people can be misled by faulty memories, by not being able to evaluate the frequency of coincidences and things of that sort. And so I'd sort of poo-poo what they would say. Now I say, well, we have good laboratory evidence, strong laboratory evidence that these things actually occur. And it's impossible after the fact for me to, you know, to prove that you really did experience something quite extraordinary or not. But it's certainly a possibility. And then I recommend 2 books to them to read. One of them, for people who are really interested in seeing the whole field, is Dean Radin's own book called Entangled Minds, which actually attempts to use quantum mechanics in a way that people can understand to see if that may contain the physics that would help us explain how ESP works. The second book I suggest to them is by Larry Dossey, who is actually an MD who works on alternative methods of healing, has written a book called The Science of Premonitions. And it's very good. It's, first of all, it's accurate. But it's a nice combination of anecdotes that people report to me, of the kind people report to me, and the science that we know about with regard to premonitions, including lots and lots of things that occurred around 9/11, of people who appear to have had foreknowledge of the 9/11 incidents. So I no longer poo-poo these people, and in recommending these books, it first of all tells people they're not alone, and also gives them the scientific background. Mm-hmm. To people who believe too quickly, I then give them a standard lecture on the way in which our minds mislead us about things.
Right, and I think that's valid to throw that in the mix. But I have to say, in having researched this as much as I have, as much or little as I have over the last few years, that seems to me to be often overblown and exaggerated. It's kind of like when you were alluding to the story of the magician, and we need to bring the magician in the lab to control these experiments. It always seemed like a little bit over the top in terms of a good scientist can develop controls that automatically develops controls that are pretty darn tight. And they might make mistakes now and then, but I got to believe that they're on top of their game.
I agree with you on that. And in fact, it's been my experience that parapsychologists are actually better methodologists than most of the people I know in psychology generally. They know about things that psychologists themselves rarely have to think about. And so in my paper, I go into a detailed discussion of the difference between different kinds of random number generators that choose, you know, what the event will be that the person's trying to predict. And most psychologists have never heard of the distinction between those two that I know of, and just the details of the methodology. The journals in parapsychology are among the very few that openly welcome and promise to publish negative results as well. So you don't have the file drawer problem nearly as severely, because they will do that. And I've been the editor of Journal of Personality and Social Psychology, a section editor on that in the past, and now I'm as an associate editor on the Journal of Scientific Exploration, which publishes a lot of the ESP stuff. And we're just as rigorous in our, you know, in our evaluation of the experimental controls. The reason that I was invited was that followed that to talk about magic and warning about them, is a laboratory was fooled by Randy.
But I think when you really look at the history of what happened there, it's mm-hmm. another Randy con job. They weren't fooled anywhere near to the extent that he portrayed. Isn't that correct?
Yes. But we ourselves were critical of that particular lab. We thought they weren't as careful as they should have been. But they never published anything, you know, based on the phony guys who had been planted there. So that's true. But that what I was trying to say is this was the era when the fear of God had been put into some of the parapsychologists.
Right, by the old trickster himself, James Randi.
Yes.
Dr. Bemp, what do you think is going to happen with this latest round of debunking? The skeptics have risen up, and it seems like a very well-organized, concerted effort to knock down your research. What do you think is going to happen? What do you think is their game plan? I think I can see part of the game plan, you know, where it was Wiseman originally published some rather kind of obscure objections that you pretty quickly knocked down, and then he wanted a very controlled, you had to file for replication with him to make sure that there weren't any file drawer problem that you talked about. What do you think the game plan is, and how do you think it's eventually going to play out in terms of this debunking effort?
Well, I think the flurry of activity in the popular media will just sort of die down. And when I look at Google News on it, there are still four or five articles that pop up in which it just shows how successful Wiseman is at getting his point of view out. I have been I've been replying to people who've asked me to reply to blogs and things of that sort. And without accusing him of actually being dishonest, he has now published the three studies that he and French and Ritchie have tried to get published in several journals that rejected it. And I replied with a comment on that. If there's anything dishonest there, is when you publish an article, even if it's of your own three experiments — they did three experiments that failed on one of my, trying to replicate one of my experiments — you always have a literature review section where you talk about all the previous research and known research on the topic before you present your own data. And what Weissman never tells people is, in Ritchie, Weissman, and French, the thing that they published, their three failures, is that his online registry, where he asked everyone to register, first of all, he provided a deadline date to be included in that. You had to have completed it by December 1st. Well, that's, 6 months after my article appeared. And I don't know of any serious researcher working on their own stuff who is going to drop everything and immediately do a replication.
And why would there need to be that kind of deadline to begin with? I mean, it's completely contrived to work only in support of his effort. I mean,
well, unless he just underestimated or overestimated how many people were going to drop everything and try to replicate it. Anyway, he and Ritchie and French published these three studies. Well, they knew that there were three other studies that had been submitted and completed, and two of the three showed statistically significant results replicating my results.
Right.
But you don't know that from reading his article, and that borders on dishonesty.
Right. So what do you think the future holds for this research? Do you think there will be other attempts to replicate it? Will this become...
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there are some. There are already ongoing. And I think it'll probably settle down. There won't be this immediate thing. And at some point, there will be enough studies that we could actually begin to know, to figure out exactly what's causing replication successes and what causes replication failures. And one of the points I make in my commentary, and I really believe, is I think the experimenter's attitudes and expectations about the effect affect the results.
I'm sorry, but that experimenter effect is an idea that's, one, been floating around there experimentally for a while, and two, is, gosh, I mean, how could it not be a factor given what we already know about size?
Exactly.
So I think that's kind of interesting.
Yeah, but then the skeptics are quick to jump on it and saying, well, then what you're saying is no one else who doesn't believe it already can replicate it. And that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that we need to incorporate the experimenter's attitudes and expectations as variables in our attempts to replicate.
Right.
I mean, the two other replications, independent replications, that are in his registry were done by people who are at least neutral or believers that psi exists. And Ritchie and French and Weissman are all well-known skeptics.
Right.
And they got no results. And the real irony is that Weissman himself was in an experiment, as you know, probably from Carolyn Watt's interview, in an experiment with Marilyn Schlitz. Marilyn Schlitz is somebody who's, first of all, a very talented experimenter and often gets very good positive results in psi experiments. And she's president at the Noetic Institute. And she and Richard Weissman collaborated on three studies of a psi effect in which they used the same subjects. They did it in the same laboratory. In fact, it was Weissman's own laboratory for two of them. And randomly assigned themselves to different sessions. And Marilyn got positive results, and Weissman never did. And so we have a beautiful demonstration right there of, when a skeptic and a proponent of psi get together and do an experiment, the proponent gets positive results and the skeptic does not.
Right, and don't you think that would fit into this broader picture that we're getting of consciousness beyond brain activity, consciousness being larger than just what's inside our brain. If that, in fact, and the trend line definitely seems to be in that direction, in this interconnected universe that we live in, why would we not expect those kind of effects to happen to begin with? So it always seems kind of disingenuous when skeptics just want to roll their eyes and laugh and say, oh, experimenter effect. It's like, how could we not have an experimenter effect if there is, in fact, an effect going on at all?
Yeah, well, and when the fact that we see experimenter effects, even in, I mean, back in the 60s when this was being investigated so intensively, you could lead experimenters to believe, for example, that certain rats had been bred to be brighter than other rats, even though they were just randomly picked. And the experimenters who expected their rats to run the maze faster did so. Yeah. So if you can find experimenter effects there, it's hardly a novelty that we can find it in an area like psi. But I agree with you. It's it does say something about non-local knowledge, the non-locality of our own bodies and minds.
Dr. Behm, for those folks who want to learn more about your research and maybe fill up your inbox more with their stories of precognition and other accounts, how can they learn more about your work and tell us a little bit about what's coming up for you, particularly with this subject? How much do you plan on staying involved with it, and how much would you like to maybe move on to other work?
Well, I'm now retired. I'm Professor Emeritus, as you said. And so I'm probably going to close my actual laboratory, which I'm still running, at the end of this semester. That's my current plan. And then probably investigate the characteristics of successful and unsuccessful replicators, because that is an area of interest to me. Mm-hmm. I have a background in personality psychology as well. And so I'm interested in that because I'm interested in being able to show stronger replication effects. What I've been doing in my lab since the publication is trying to take a couple of the experiments and see if I can't make them stronger, because it would be the stronger the effect, the easier it would be for other people to find.
Right, right. Great. How ironic that would be, since one of the strategies of the debunkers has long been to kind of psychologize the phenomena and say, well, we don't need to study the phenomena. We need to study these weird people who report and believe these weird things. Wouldn't it be ironic if it turns out we need to look at the beliefs and psychology of the experimenters and why they don't believe and why they don't get these effects? It's
curious. Well, and the other thing that's funny is, you know, they're always yammering at us about the file drawer effect, namely that there are studies that we only know about the positive studies, but it turns out they themselves have a file drawer effect too. They suppress, they suppress positive findings. So the file drawer works both ways.
Right. And in this case, it's much more significant really if you hide a positive result, or it potentially could be much more significant. I guess it would really just depend on the results. So there's really probably no inherent advantage to suppression is suppression, right?
Yeah.
Well, Dr. Behm, it's been great, great pleasure having you on the show. Thanks so much, and best of luck with all your future work.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thanks again to Daryl Behm for joining me today on Skeptico. There are a lot of interesting points that came up in this interview, but I'll pull out a couple. First is the experimenter effect, the idea that the researcher, the person conducting the experiment, can actually have an influence on the results. You know, when you put it one way, it's obvious. And when you put it another way, it kind of throws science for a real loop. I mean, that then becomes something that we need to factor into each and every experiment. So it's easy to see why a lot of folks might be resistant to that. The other topic I draw your attention to and ask for your input on in the forum or comment section of this show is this idea of whether or not it's fair to look at someone's political or religious affiliations when considering where they're coming from. I think it is. I think we all do it all the time. So I think to say that this or that skeptic is a radicalized atheist because their other public activities show that they are, I think that's fair game. I mean, it's in the public arena, and I think it's naive to think that that kind of political and religious orientation doesn't factor into their worldview. I think it's naive to think so. So why shouldn't we factor that in? Well, those are at least a couple of topics that we can pull out and maybe discuss after the show if you want to join me again on the forum or for the comment section of this website, which you will find at skeptiko.com, skeptiko.com. And there you'll also find links to all our previous shows and an email and Facebook link to me. Well, I have a number of interesting shows coming up, some that are turning out to be really some of my favorite shows ever. So I certainly hope you'll stick with me for all of that and tell everyone you care to about Skeptiko and have folks join us and listen in and add to this dialogue that we're having. But until all that, I hope you will take care and bye for now.